Hi, I'm Bobby McCormick, and you're listening to the Breffni Early Show.
Breffni, you come all the way from Ireland for this adventure.
Isn't Breffni Early a real tonic, full of positivity?
It's an amazing story, Breffni, with a wonderful, happy ending.
All of those things on your bucket list wouldn't necessarily have led you to do the World Cycle Race.
27 countries, 490 days, 18,000 miles on a bike.
You've decided that's it, you're going to keep giving yourself challenges.
Welcome to the Breffni Early Show. Each week we try and bring you somebody interesting, inspirational and motivational so you can get a little snippet of what it is like to be them, but also what you need to do if you want to replicate the kind of work that they do themselves in their everyday lives. This week we have another individual who perfectly fits that description, Bobby McCormick. Welcome to the show.
Cheers, Breffni. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Bobby, we're going to talk a lot about Development Perspectives, which is your charity that you founded with your wife.
Yes, indeed. Now wife. She wasn't when we founded the organization, but I persuaded her since.
Yeah, she who shall be obeyed, I presume, is her other title.
For sure. Absolutely. Yeah. She is the boss.
Happy wife, happy life, isn't that what they say? And we're going to talk about that in the future. But first of all, I want to talk about why you were in a position that you felt you needed to found a charity back in the mid-2000s. First of all, tell us a bit about Bobby McCormick, where you come from, what your story is.
Sure. So I'll go back a little bit. I'm from Drogheda. I went to secondary school in St. Joseph's CBS in Drogheda. I was persuaded during my last year there to try mechanical engineering in Dundalk IT. Sadly, that didn't work at all. I think I left within maybe 6 weeks of starting the course. And so my early years after leaving secondary school were very much, I suppose, a mix of trying to find out what I wanted to do with my life, trying to figure out what the next steps might be. And during that time, I traveled quite a lot. So my kind of like formative years, I think, after leaving school were very instrumental in shaping my worldview, if you like. And I'm still very grateful now looking back the opportunities that travel provided me, because they definitely, I think, gave me an education that I wouldn't have got if I had have stayed in college. And it was only then in my mid-20s that I returned to education and went back and did a degree in education and training.
Well, where did you get a chance to visit when you in those early 20s?
So I suppose the most exciting trip I can remember in those early years was over to India. The first time I was ever on an aeroplane was going to India. So at that stage, I mean, Ryanair weren't around really in the same way.
Ryanair didn't fly to India anyway, unfortunately.
Indeed. But just in terms of people traveling, I mean, it was, you know, people traveled in a very different way. You know, that's not too long ago, but like low-cost travel really wasn't on the agenda for anyone. So it took a lot of effort to get the money for an airfare anywhere, whether that be to America, whether that be to England, or whether that be to India. But I had a wonderful opportunity to travel around India for a short amount of time, but it was very much a life-changing experience. I saw firsthand, I suppose, many of the things I read about while I was studying in St. Joseph's in secondary school. Some of the documentaries that I would have been interested in as a teenager, I then saw in front of me, and that was very fundamentally important for me in shaping, I suppose, my ideas and what I wanted to do with the opportunities that life gave me in Ireland.
So let's talk about Development Perspectives and the origins of that. So we're talking mid-2000s, 2005, 2006, and you probably tell it better than I'm going to tell it. So tell us a little bit about how that worked out.
Sure. So as I said, my own background is education and training, and I was working as a freelance facilitator. And my then girlfriend, who's now wife, Margaret Downey, her background was in health. And we were both very interested in working in the areas we were in. But we were also very interested in development issues, things like poverty and inequality. But we had no way into those sectors. We didn't have the language. We didn't have the qualifications. But around that time, that awful tsunami happened in Southeast Asia. I think it was Christmas 2004. And within maybe a couple of months, we had both decided that it would be really, I suppose, a moment that we could park what we were doing at that stage of our lives, take a little bit of a chance, and try to contribute in a way that we hadn't done up until then. So we felt it was important to maybe go to Sri Lanka and see what we could do. Looking back, it was quite a naive notion, but I think an important one, because what we got from the experience of being in Sri Lanka in 2005 led to the birth of Development Perspectives. when we were in Sri Lanka, we'd realized that our view of what development NGOs do was very different to what they actually do on the ground.
Okay, you mentioned this to me off air beforehand, but let's break it down. What were your expectations going to Sri Lanka?
I think I was hoping that organizations were very responsive to the needs of people on the ground. I was hoping that organizations were very respectful of the cultures in which they work. I was hoping that organizations would involve local people as much as possible. Yeah, they were the hopes that I had, but that was in remove from any previous experience that I had of what they did. I was relying very much on information I would have got through fundraising campaigns that organizations would do, or the little that I had read up until then about what organizations were involved in. But the reality that I saw firsthand in Sri Lanka was very distant to those views that I had in advance.
What were you faced when you actually landed in Sri Lanka?
Well, the first thing that I realized was that how many organizations were there. So how many international organizations were active in Sri Lanka. But were active in very different ways. Many of the Irish development NGOs, the big ones, the ones that are well known internationally, the likes of Goal, Concern and others were there. And they would be very much on the good end of the spectrum in terms of development work internationally, Troker of course as well. But not all organizations operate to the same standards. And what you found, I think, in Sri Lanka was a mix and match of organizations that were quite amateur, I think, would be fair to say, and also quite removed from what people wanted. When we spoke and worked with local organizations, grassroots organizations in Sri Lanka, they really weren't looking for what organizations were providing. They weren't interested really in what some organizations were there to do. And in fact, many Sri Lankan people wanted really international NGOs to leave. That's of course not to say all of them felt like that, and it's of course not to say that they felt all organizations should go, but it was very much a widely held opinion that organizations weren't responding to what the real needs were on the ground.
What were the needs on the ground?
So since then, I suppose, a good friend of mine who works in development would say a good starting place for development organizations is asking. Now, I know a lot of organizations say they do, but sometimes it's tokenistic, that they're not really listening to what people are saying they want. So in the first couple of months after the Sri Lankan tsunami in the Southeast Asia tsunami in general, what people needed was a humanitarian response. That was true. They needed shelter. They needed bodies removed from lagoons. They needed buildings to be rebuilt. But then it quickly moves on past a humanitarian response into something that's more medium to long term. And that's where the discrepancies begin to appear. Local fishing communities wanted access to fishing again, but they weren't allowed to have that. A lot of the coastal regions were being bought up by private hotels, private companies that were European-based, not necessarily Sri Lankan-based at all. And many of the organizations were not interested in what locals were saying, i.e. they wanted lobbying and advocacy to get access to their livelihoods again. And that wasn't possible. The Sri Lankan government had brought in legislation to remove fishing communities from those local areas and push them inland. Now, those communities relied not on third-level qualifications or anything like it, but on skills that had been passed down generation to generation. Their only hope for livelihood was those skills that they had built over years. And what they wanted was access to the waters. But sadly, NGOs weren't doing any of that kind of work. They weren't doing any advocacy, they weren't doing any lobbying, they weren't doing capacity building, and they were doing very simplistic stuff that wasn't really providing what they needed. So they were building houses. People in Sri Lanka can build houses. There's plenty of builders available to do all sorts of building. So I think that what began to emerge in 2005 was the discrepancy between the tension of what local communities were saying and then what NGOs were providing.
In terms of what you brought to the table in Sri Lanka in 2005, what benefit did your presence there have?
Didn't have any, and that was the point. From our point of view, being there didn't help at all. That myself and my wife, who both at the time had qualifications and experience in our respective fields, we didn't have anything to offer. We were very motivated, we were very interested, but in many ways we were a hindrance rather than a help. Local people were very generous of their time and very generous to us in terms of personally, but literally anything we could do could have been done locally by other people. There was virtually nothing that we could do that they couldn't do for themselves. However, there were things that they wanted to do that weren't being done, which we felt then we were in a position to do. As I say, going back to the educational point of view, there were certain things going on that Sri Lankan people felt internationally people needed to know about, like, as I say, the buying up of hotels on coastal stretches, the kind of capture of lucrative resources by people based in Europe. That's what they wanted us to work on, because we had access to MEPs, we had access to TDs in Ireland, we had access to things that were going on that they felt we could help with. But in terms of actively being there and doing anything that was constructive, I would have to say, in hindsight, looking back, we had the best of intentions, but really that's all we had. We didn't have anything tangible to offer.
The difference was, though, that you didn't continue to just keep doing that over and over again. You came home with a plan. Mm. What happened when you came home from Sri Lanka?
So we realized, I suppose, that, and anyone who's traveled, I think, will recognize this, or anyone involved in education and training, is that seeing is believing. And sometimes experience can transform people. And so what we wanted to do was to design a program, an educational program, that was non-formal, no degrees attached, no kind of assessments needed, but that would allow people to have the opportunity to see themselves what poverty is like, to see for themselves what inequality, what conflict, what climate change is like in a different part of the world. We wanted to challenge people's perspectives. We wanted to challenge people's views of what is going on in this world of ours. And that's what gave birth to Developing Perspectives. We wanted to give people the opportunity that we had in Sri Lanka to see things from a different point of view, to park the notions that they had about maybe the way that the world operates and power and the way that it works and why people live in poverty, and really challenge that. So that's exactly what we did. We set up a program for adults based on the notion that we would share with each other, you know, share with communities in Sri Lanka our views, and they would share with us their views. And it would be a very respectful base, a partnership base that we would adhere to in terms of values, but it would be reciprocated. So those people from Sri Lanka who take part in the program would then come to Ireland and see for themselves and challenge their views of what Ireland is like. Because in the same way we've got views of other parts of the world, other people have views of Ireland that is based on things not too distant from leprechauns and Guinness. That's as far as maybe their knowledge or understanding would go, would be of Ireland. Roy Keane, Bono, and a few other bits and pieces. But Ireland's got a rich history. It's got a lot of reasons, I suppose, that encourage us to look at development more worldly, more globally. So I think that Ireland is a good place to do this type of program from. And and that gave birth, as I said, to Developing Perspectives.
What was the first kind of foray into that world as an organization? What was the roots of the organization?
So we took a group in 2016, that's this year, of course. We took a group in 2006 back to the community that we lived in the previous year. We brought a group of, I think it was 15 people from Ireland. We met up with a group of 15 people from Sri Lanka, and we had three really intensive weeks of learning and challenging each other in Tangal in southern Sri Lanka. We worked with coastal conservation projects, we worked with development NGOs, we brought in locals, we visited hospitals, schools, we had a whole range of discussions and debates. And then later on that year, some of the participants from Sri Lanka came to Ireland and spent some time in Drogheda in November 2006. They were met by the then Minister for Foreign Affairs, Dermot Ahern. We had a big exhibition in Drogheda in the Dráthad Arts Centre. And since then, the organisation has grown and really gone from strength to strength. Many of the people who were involved in 2006 are still involved in our work. Many people that had a life-changing experience are still doing wonderful work. We can't say we can claim credit for all of that, but we can say is that our contribution made a difference and made an impact in the long term for those people. Like, the range of people that take part is important, because they themselves are maybe teachers or youth workers or social workers or journalists, or, you know, it doesn't really make much odds what people are, but it's that they've got the chance to access and multiply, be agents of change in their own communities. And that group from 2006 and every group since has been that.
How did you fund that initial trip?
We applied for a pilot project to Irish Aid, and we were very grateful of the support that we got in 2006 and very grateful of the support that we've got since then from Irish Aid. They took a chance, I suppose, on supporting a project that wasn't well regarded at the time, wasn't well known. But we got a small amount of money that allowed us to really kind of try something. And we tried it, and it worked, and the evaluation showed that it worked. And since then, we've been very careful to constantly look for evidence that what we're claiming works actually works. There's a big difference between having the evidence to back up what you're trying to do than just saying that it's a good idea.
What is Development Perspectives now? Where is the organization in terms of its structure, in terms of its impact on the world, both in Ireland and abroad?
Sure. So Development Perspectives is in a very positive place at the moment. We're very lucky to have a wonderful staff team. We've got a staff team of 5 people who work part-time. We've got a wonderful board of management that consists of 8 really committed volunteers. We've got another group of maybe 7 to 8 people that are actively involved in different projects, but on a part-time basis, but they're not staff. And then we've got a network of people that have taken part in previous projects, but that continue to support our work. And that ranges at any one given time. It goes up from a number of 15 or 20 right up to 60 or 70, depending on the projects that we have on the go. Around maybe 400 to 500 people have taken part in our main program each year. A little bit less than that have been involved in other projects. But that's kind of the scale. In terms of development work, we're very much, from an Irish perspective, on the small end of things. But we would argue we focus very clearly on a niche area, and we do it really well. Our work is well regarded internationally, both in Europe and beyond. And so what we're doing, we're going to continue to do because we know it works. But we're not going to replicate the work of other organizations. Not because we're heavily critical all the time, but because there's a gap for what we do, and we're trying to make sure that we fill that.
One of the things that you've done through either your personal life or through Development Perspectives that you're most proud of?
Wow, that's a deep one for sure. I mean, outside of Development Perspectives, I'm very proud of being involved with such a wonderful family and groups of friends that I'm lucky to have.
Because they're probably
Definitely, I'd have to. I'd get into a lot of trouble maybe over the next few hours if I don't, or a few days.
For a few weeks.
Indeed. But I am very blessed. I mean, my own mom is in a home at the moment. She hasn't been well for a long time. But, I'm blessed with the fact of having a really supportive family. I grew up in a home that really kind of encouraged me to try and dream and imagine. And I didn't grow up in an environment where I was told I had to fit into particular boxes. And looking back on that was pretty kind of ahead of the curve in terms of people. My own mom and dad hadn't gone to college. They hadn't any third level qualifications. And I now realize, looking back, that probably the most educated people in the world don't have those things. That sometimes we equate these things like third level qualifications with wisdom, and it's far removed from that. I mean, I work, and I'm blessed to work part-time in an institute of technology not far from here, and I've done so for 10 years, and I'm very glad that I've had the opportunity to meet people, but they are the privileged few, and sometimes we don't recognize that not everyone has the opportunities that others have. And my own dad would be somebody that I admire for that. I mean, at the age of 14, he went to work and worked. I don't think he missed a day. And I really think that that's the case up until he retired. And I admire that. I admire that kind of sense of hard work and determination. But he never in any way tried to get me to do what he did. It was very much a case, as I said, that they encouraged me to kind of dream and imagine and be whatever I wanted to be. And that kind of freedom allowed me to, I think, continue to do things that were a little bit different to some of my peers. You know, growing up, people went to college and then people maybe emigrated and did other things, which is great for them. But again, I was really kind of blessed to have that kind of sense of like designing your future rather than just stumbling into it.
And in terms of the Development Perspective work that you've done, what are the highlights of that over the last 10 years?
The impact of the work is phenomenal. I mean, I see so much work in so many different contexts, and I know that Development Perspectives makes a difference, both for Tanzanian participants, for Irish participants, for Liberian participants from all over the world. They tell us regularly the difference and the contribution that the programs made to their lives and to their communities. And that can't be anything but a proud moment. I have been privileged to travel, to visit places I wouldn't have got the chance to visit, to spend time with people that are inspiring. to spend time with people that I could only wish to aspire to being like in many ways. So those opportunities wouldn't have been possible without development perspectives, and for that I'm very grateful. But we do have a wonderful team in place. I mean, work of any description is only possible because of the people that are involved, and definitely the people involved in development perspectives, from the board of management to the volunteers to the staff. They are a wonderful group of motivated people.
You're name dropping countries here, like it's just Liberia, Tanzania. Mm. Where's the highlight for you? Which one is the one that, when you kind of look back at the last 10 years, that you really took pride out of? Pride is the wrong word, but if you took kind of pleasure out of just being in a place.
I do think that Tanzania in general is a...
I'm so glad you picked Tanzania.
Yeah. No, it's a wonderfully warm, welcoming place with people that extend what they call a caribou sana. They call it a very welcome. They extend it what we would equate to a Cade Mille Falcha, but they do it in spades. I mean, they do it in a way that I think that Ireland could only aspire to do it, and I really mean that in a positive way. Tanzania is a really interesting place for many reasons. It's one of the most ethnically diverse countries in the world. There's over 150 different groups of people who speak that many languages. So there's a huge diversity to the country, but there's a real beauty to the country as well, from Kilimanjaro right down to the Serengeti, and then the coastal region, Zanzibar. These are places, names of places that people will know and will recognize. And Tanzania's got all of that. And sometimes, When I talk to friends and family, sometimes they say things like, oh, it must be very challenging, it must be very difficult. Actually, it's not. To spend time in Tanzania is a real privilege and a pleasure. And I know you've got plans in the future to visit it not too far away.
Next year, it's on the bucket list.
Yeah, well, I think it's definitely something that I think you'll treasure, because being in Tanzania is a wonderful experience. There is one small village that stands out in Tanzania. It's called Arkeria. Arkeria is a Maasai village not far from Arusha in northern Tanzania, and that's a very special place, and some of your listeners will recognize it, because no doubt someone from DP will pick up on spending time in Arkeria. There's a wonderful Maasai man called Elias Marindat, who is the leader of that community, and we've been welcome to that community on many occasions, and that's certainly a place that I can't help but, when I think about, I really kind of think, wow, what a privilege it was to spend time there. So maybe I'll give you the address of Elias Marindat, and you might be able to check him out when you're over there next year.
Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned Tanzania, Kenya, that whole region, and the Maasai, because last night, and we're recording this a couple of weeks before it's going to be actually broadcast, but last night I was at a film festival where they showed a movie called Warriors, which was about a Kenyan Maasai cricket team. So a group of kids got together, a South African lady arrived into the community, she decided she was going to teach the boys how to play cricket, and eventually that also became teach the girls how to play cricket, and you're very familiar with the Maasai because you've met them, but the females in that, like, we think the females aren't treated equally here. It's a totally different kettle of fish with the Maasai. The women just do what they're told and they don't say anything. And obviously, female genital mutilation is a huge issue in the Maasai at the moment. And that was the kind of the subcontext of this cricket team, was they were invited to England to play in a tournament. And they went to the tournament and they opened their eyes and they opened their perspectives, for want of a better word. It's quite an appropriate word today. On how women are treated in particular, and they brought that back to their tribe. And one of the key, I'm not going to ruin the movie, but hopefully not going to ruin the movie for people who do go and watch it, Warriors, it was released last year, it's an excellent production. But they bring it back to the elders of the tribe, and there's one scene towards the end of the movie where the young men of the tribe, the maybe guys in their teens and 20s, are discussing with the elders, their fathers effectively, about this situation for female genital mutilation and whether women should be circumcised or not. And the tradition, even though it's illegal, the tradition was still to practice that, because the men wouldn't marry a girl unless she had been through that process. And so the discussion with the older men was, well, they're your future wives, you tell us what you want. And the men were saying, well, if we're not going to marry someone if she has been circumcised, so we don't want this practice to continue. And the elders, and it happens so quickly in the film and in the discussion, it happens almost in a minute or two. It's just, well, what do you want? And the young men say, well, we want this, we want this practice to change. And the older men agree, and it's agreed, and it happens. And it doesn't, the in that particular tribe of the Maasai, it's discontinued. And you look at how a simple cricket tour to the UK for practically every young guy between the age of maybe 18 and 30 in the tribe, all of a sudden it changes the future for that tribe in a huge way, in a very personal way for half of the tribe.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, what you describe, I think, echoes some of what we try to do in the work of developing perspectives. We try to use approaches. In that case, it was sport, trying to use sport in a way that was engaging for people, but had a sub-context to it. You're trying to deliver a little bit on something else. And we try to use that a lot. We try to use art-based approaches, sport-based approaches. We try to use documentary. We try to use a lot of approaches to engage people and involve people. Because even that process that you describe about that consultation between the elders and what's known as the Morani, the warriors within a tribe, they happen in a particular way, and again, seeing is believing. By being in a community and seeing that and being allowed to be there to take part in it is a really, really interesting process. And then for them to see when they come to Ireland how maybe we make decisions or don't, as the case may be with our government at the moment. Yeah, it's a really interesting reciprocal process. But again, we can make too many prejudicial decisions or judgments of other people without knowing the detail of what's going on. And I think it's really, really vital that people begin to kind of consider a little bit more why things are the way they are, to be a bit more critical of the causes to things rather than just concentrate on the effects of it.
What are you working on at the moment within development perspectives? What's the future hold for you, say, in the next 12 months? Are there any particular initiatives that people might be interested in getting involved in?
Yeah, so we have a few really exciting projects coming up. We've got a project kicking off on the 4th of May called the SDG Challenge. Last year, leaders of the world came together to agree on 17 different goals called the Sustainable Development Goals. And in Drogheda, we're having the launch of our particular efforts to contribute to those goals. So that'll kick off on the 4th. And every month then we will go from one goal to another. So for the first month, we will be looking at poverty and what causes poverty and what people can do to alleviate it. And then each month we'll go on from there. We have plans to produce a documentary about the life of Mary Martin, the founder of the Medical Missionaries of Mary. So we're hoping to shoot that over the next couple of months. And then our annual insight program, we're bringing a group to Tanzania in the end of June for 3 weeks, and then our Tanzanian colleagues will come back to Ireland in October. And this year we're hoping to use a lot more mobile journalism and do a lot more street art during those activities. So people hopefully around different communities around Ireland might get involved in some of those actions, which of course will all be well flagged on all of our social media platforms. So people can get involved.
Give a bit of a plug there. Where can people find you on the Twitter universe?
Yeah, I mean, we're always, it's a good thing that you mentioned, because I suppose people often ask, how can you get involved? I mean, from our point of view, people who get involved in writing a blog for us, it maybe is as important as by going to Tanzania in a way, because we're not just looking for people to get involved in an overseas context. We want to challenge poverty and inequality in Ireland. And what we'd like to do is to get many more people involved in our work, as you say, through the likes of Twitter or Facebook. We've got a really healthy blog called See the World Differently, and we're always looking for contributions to that blog. And we're always looking for more friends and likes on Facebook and Twitter, because we want to widen the kind of the audience that we engage with directly. We're not looking to transmit communication, we're looking to engage in communication with people. And the more that we do, the more then we feel people will be informed of what's really happening. I mean, recently, just in the last few days, the whole Panama Papers thing has kicked off. And for us, tax justice is really key, that we could fund an awful lot of the challenges that face Ireland. We don't need to come up with new money, we just need to get people to pay their fair share. It's not a radical idea. I mean, anyone who pays PAYE pays their contribution. What we're looking for is for wealthy people to pay their fair share. That's not radical. I think that's just common sense. But sadly, there are many companies that do very well of encouraging people not to do that. And so as an NGO, we've got a responsibility to try and tackle that. So we're looking for people to get involved.
Won't that always be a problem, though? And I know it's very current at the moment, and the Icelandic, at the time of recording this, the Icelandic Prime Minister dissolved cabinet dissolved the government yesterday, and I think the repercussions are going to be felt for the next few weeks. But aren't wealthy people always going to find somebody, no more than the drug issue in sport, you're always going to find a doctor who's prepared to do whatever he has to do to get you on the podium, aren't you always going to find somebody somewhere who's going to find a loophole that avoids the super rich from paying tax?
I think you're always going to have people that will try to do that. I think that's absolutely the case. But I am an optimist and not a kind of like an idealist. I think that if you look through history, there's always been times where people have said it will always be like this. So we go back to slavery times in North America, where people would say, well, the black will never get a vote in this country. That changed. If you look back to the suffragettes and what they did with women, and there's been times in our history where it's been difficult to see beyond the difficulty that we're in. And Ireland's history, I think, is a reminder of that. I mean, we were colonized. We did have conflict. And some would argue in a very minor way, we still have a type of conflict in some parts of this island. But that aside, I think that what we've got to do is to look to what it could be and what it could be. If we can send people to space, we can solve the tax issue. I think that for sure it'll be difficult because there are powers that don't want it to be solved. There are institutes that actively today will look to try and stop and counter our efforts and the efforts of the likes of many other organizations. But I think we've got to be optimistic. I'm reminded of a quote from Gorbachev where he said, if not me, who? If not now, when? And I think that the scale of the problems that when you go overseas or when you are in Ireland looking at things like homelessness, the scale of those issues require us to look at ways of solving them. And sadly, one way of contributing is very straightforward, is tax justice. But you're dead right. I mean, there are people that don't want that to happen. And there will be people that will be very well paid to that will continue to look for loopholes.
That's my point. If someone's making $1 billion a year, yeah, for argument's sake, and they're supposed to pay half of that to tax in whatever country, they just give $100 million to a tax consultant who reduces their tax debt to zero or very close to it. It's a good investment on a business level, obviously not on a social level. It's an awful investment for the community that person should be contributing to. I'm going to finish up with you today because I know we're a bit tight for time, but we always finish each of our podcasts with the same question. What can the listeners of the podcast do for Bobby McCormick and Development Perspectives? If you had one ask, what would it be?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. For us, it would be just get involved in our work. What I mean by that is it doesn't have to be with Development Perspectives, but I hope it would be. We're not looking for people's cash. What we're looking for is their involvement, their participation. Because for us, our theory of change is based on more people being informed, and then as a result of that deeper awareness and knowledge, more people deciding to take action. And if people take action, things change.
Bobby McCormick, absolutely fantastic answer to the question. Loved spending a half an hour with you this morning. Thank you very much for your time.
Cheers, Bradley.
And best of luck for everything with Development Perspectives and in your personal life into the future.
Thank you so much, Bradley.